Electric cars are so much more common than they once were. By now, all of us have been surprised in a parking lot or on a quiet street by a car creeping up behind us, quiet for the lack of gas engine sounds. But if electric cars were doing all the things of gas-powered cars, we might all be driving them now. Electric cars still have some limits, the biggest being how far they can travel on a single charge. Lots of people are working on that issue, on the next generation of batteries. That's a story our next guest tells in detail in his book, Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War, now out in paperback. Steve Levine is the author. He's a Washington correspondent for Quartz, QZ.com, writing about energy, technology, and politics and where they meet. He's a former foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and he's a future tense fellow at the New America Foundation, plus a teacher of energy security at Georgetown. Steve Levine, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Grouping of the words I see is very important. You're a future tense fellow, not a future. What is that?
New America Foundation, one of the think tanks in Washington, they have a program that looks at various questions involving the future. This is technology, but also social trends and so on. And how do we name that? How should we brand it? And I don't know who, but someone came up with the idea, future tense. And then in the program, there are the people involved in it, the fellows, and I'm one of those.
Okay. I have to believe there's all sorts of other fun titles like Future Tense Manager or something. All kinds of great things. Okay, enough about the joke. So out of the future tense and to the present, and one of the good things that comes out of this book is your ability to turn around and look at projections that were made for this time years ago. So, for example, are electric cars as widely used now as was hoped, for example, in 2010?
No. Like a lot of technologies where you have people who have skin in the game, meaning money to make or government policies to sell, forecasts that are made to sell them don't often materialize. So in this case, both in China and the United States, there were supposed to be 1 million electric cars on the road by now, and it's not that they're embarrassingly small, but there are a couple of hundred thousand on the road in the United States, less in China. Also, the size of the market is much smaller than it was supposed to be by now. When you look at it through that lens, it didn't quite reach what it was cracked up to be.
Didn't get to the bold projections.
It didn't.
The recent reports of a Tesla's Model S outselling gas luxury cars, was that accurate or was it qualified in some way?
Well, in its space. So the S is compared to the same pricing point of Mercedes and BMW, which seems to me a fair comparison, and it did outsell those. And the important point about that is the reaction by the major car makers, German car makers, also American and Japanese, and that's that they've taken the electric car market into the next stage. So you had all those cars that came out about 2009, 2010, the Chevy Volt, the Nissan Leaf, for example, and those were burdened by the handicaps that you hinted at in the lead-in. They cost a lot. The cars didn't go far enough. Take a long time to charge. So they only sold, a few tens of thousands, and to whom did they sell? They sold to a niche of people who are extremely green minded or who are trying to make a statement in their neighborhood. They didn't break out into the mainstream. So this next stage, the one that's starting this year, and that GM signaled about two or three weeks ago at the annual electronics show in Las Vegas, it unveiled the Chevy Bolt. It's an all-electric car. It's in the mainstream price $30,000, and instead of only going 37 miles, it goes 200 miles on a charge. It's coming up for sale in December, and this really, it's a statement that these years right now, this half decade leading up to 2020, is a new proving ground. Can electric cars break out of the niche and into the mainstream?
And that was Chevy Bolt with a B?
That's right. They've been very confusing.
Uh-huh.
First, they came out with a Volt, with a plug-in hybrid, and are they lacking in creativity? I have no idea, but the best they could come up with for their pure electric is Bolt with a B.
Wow. Steve, give us some idea of how closely our government scientists work with the car business on electric vehicles.
Well, the lab that I sat in to write the book, you know, I sat with a group of a half dozen scientists at a government lab, Federal Argonne National Lab, which is just outside of Chicago. I sat in that lab for 2 years, and their stuff is the battery in the Chevy Volt and in the Chevy Bolt and a number of other vehicles. The government, the U.S. government, the stuff that it has produced is very, very important to what car makers are putting onto the market.
All right, much more to talk about with Steve Levine. His book is called Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War, about the quest for the next battery that'll take electric cars into the mainstream. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your phone calls and emails are welcome. We'll come back and talk more with Steve and talk to you as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Steve Levine, Washington correspondent for Quartz at QZ.com and the author of Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. It's all about batteries, particularly for cars, and trying to get to the next generation of battery that will put electric cars firmly in the mainstream. Quite a quest, quite well detailed in the book. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Steve, I guess ultimately the question about how closely our government scientists work with the car industry on EVs is about division of labor. This is not quite like the moonshot, in the sense that there were no private space agencies when we began trying to put people on the moon, which we did in a pretty short amount of time. This, A, seems to be taking longer. B, seems to be more scattered.
It is. It has not the race for the better battery, even though it would have a tremendous payoff in terms of industry, in terms of economics, but also in terms of making a dent in climate change and so on, has not taken on the tone of a mission. It is scattered. So there are a number of national labs around the country that are working on it, startups in Silicon Valley, Boston, and elsewhere, but also very similar efforts, government and industry-led efforts in South Korea, in China, and in Japan. I'm sure that won't surprise anyone. That's the nature of the race. But it's such a huge challenge getting there that's what you have to. You must have the government behind you. I'm not sure that the public has the appetite to accept a mission-driven project, though, like the moonshot.
All right. So lay out the advantages that would accrue to, I mean, besides bragging rights, to the country that would be first with this next generation battery.
Well, first of all, the one that everyone is looking for is remember the roots of this are the financial crash. Around the world, doubts were created about the market after being broadsided by the cratering of the financial community, of the banking community. There were doubts raised. What kind of industry can come up that can propel an economy and make, you know, create a lot of jobs, make a lot of people rich? And so imagination came to center on electric cars and batteries. So that's the big thing. That's the number one. Can you create a new, for example, in our country, a new Detroit, half a dozen big car companies employing a lot of people, making cars that people really want to buy and that do the things that people really want now. So what do they want? They not only want something to get them from A to B, but they want it to be electronics on wheels. Now people want autonomous functionality. They would like to have the car park itself. So you can see that if you're changing that industry into something completely different, this takes on great scale. It really is an economy builder. And out of that, you know, just in terms again of the United States, we're mentally in this framework of American decline. You even have the potential to reverse that.
I do notice that it seems like for people in their 20s and their 30s, where for previous generations the most important thing you owned outside of your home was your car, but the electronics seem to be a great deal more important. And I can see that in what you're talking about, though, is that we have expectations of the next generation of cars to be more customizable, in a sense, more like our phones in that way, that, you know, we're loaded with apps and can do things like park themselves, like you said.
Well, that's right. The whole image of the car, first, are we just what you're raising? Since new generation doesn't have the same mental attachment to a car that prior generations have had, they have their electronics. Are we going to sell as many cars? But the other thing, I think this right here raises a very important point. There's sort of the idea that there's still a doubt out there about electric cars, about whether they're going to make it. And in my view, they've already proven that they're real. And the only question is, do they move from being a niche product into being a mainstream product? And that's what we're watching right now. My own view is that it does move into the niche, and it is because of what you just stated, and that's consumer taste. The new consumers want electronics on wheels. They will want autonomous functionality, and they will not accept. They will consider it to be unseemly to drive a vehicle that's predominantly running on gasoline. They will regard that as the equivalent of, what the generation in the 1960s went through regarding throwing garbage on the side of the road, throwing garbage out of your window. Uh-huh. Yeah, it'll simply be seen as a sort of a natural thing. You buy a pure electric car, or you buy a very juiced up hybrid.
Let's take a call here. We have Alex and Ashlyn on the line. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Levine, the author of Powerhouse.
Hi. I have a comment. I don't know if it's a question. He may want to comment on it. I think, although, of course, we're waiting for the breakthrough battery technology, I think there's a hidden elephant in the room here that is inhibiting the widespread acceptance of electric cars, and that's a massive hidden subsidies in gasoline prices. If you go on the web and Google true cost of gasoline, you can get different analyses and you can quibble with them, but they range from $10 a gallon to $20 a gallon, aside from tax subsidies. Some of the analysts are figuring in the cost of protecting the oil lanes. And if we were paying the true cost of gas at the pump, out of pocket, there would be 3-year waiting lines for electric cars right now. with the current technology.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Alex. Appreciate that. Steve, anything you'd add?
No, I think it's true. You know, when you throw in the cost, for example, to the environment and the tax breaks that oil companies do receive, the price of a gallon of gas is much higher. That said, we should have some doubts that's going to go away. Electric car makers, battery makers, have to make it competitively in the current environment, and not hope that somehow the mantra and the policies around oil are going to change.
Steve Levine, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War, now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about electric cars and what it will take to move them into the mainstream and the quest for the batteries that will make that happen. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. If for the country that gets this next generation battery first, and that's assuming they don't all go, me first, and it becomes a bit of an argument over who actually got it. Do you see any sort of shuffling of the geopolitical deck based on who gets that?
This point is the one that gets me the most juiced up. What drove me to write the book? Whose geopolitical power is potentially going to rise? I think for a number of reasons, the main contest will be between China and the United States, and I do think that the one where that super battery is created, remember right now what we're seeing is the answer coming on the factory floor. Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, is building the so-called Gigafactory, and he sees his ability to create a mainstream-priced car by bringing down its costs in the factories, economies of scale. You could imagine the narrative if he wins, right? If Chevy and Tesla together, and Apple is coming in to the market, if they win this race, you could see the narrative of American decline vanishing, and the U.S. having, you know, a longer run as the predominant power in the world.
Well, and then the concerns that arise that you point out in the book about people from other countries getting access to the technology. You keep coming back to this Chinese visitor to the Argonne National Laboratory. Who was this person, and why were they there?
Wang Gong. That's his name. He still is the Minister of Science and Technology. When he visited Argonne, and I was there when he did it, the U.S. was way, way behind in the race for the battery and for the electric car. To get into the race, to be have a chance to win, we started grasping at any kind of branch that we could grab onto in order to get into the game. Very much the same thing that you saw Japan doing in the 70s when they were sending Japanese were sending dozens and scores of Japanese scientists to the United States, to factories and labs and universities, to figure out how we were doing it. So Argonne invited in, and not just Wang Gong, but other important Chinese scientists and government officials, basically as an intelligence mission. What were the Chinese doing?
Oh, so trying to get as much information from them as they might have apparently been trying to get from Argonne.
Well, it's a double intelligence game. I mean, what I saw there was Wang Gong trying to ferret out what was the United States doing, and the United States trying to figure out what were the Chinese doing.
Wow, it does get complicated, and more so than when you begin citing tensions in the book over foreign-born scientists. I mean, how dominant are they in this quest for the new battery technology within the United States?
Yeah. So, as I spent 2 years in the lab, so the the book is about them. It's about the scientists themselves trying to make this big leap, and what drives them, and their ups and downs as they're doing this. Most of them are foreign born. Americans themselves, United States born Americans, put it that way, don't want to create the next battery. Generally speaking, people going through college and graduate school, if they're going on to higher education, they're getting MBAs and law degrees, or they're getting engineering degrees. They're going into Silicon Valley or onto Wall Street. When the labs, the federal labs, and the startups, when they're sending out employment notices, announcement of jobs open, by far the stack of resumes they get are foreign. Foreign-born PhD students, mostly, and a lot of them are Chinese.
All right, let's take some calls here. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Levine. His book is Powerhouse.
Good morning. A comment and a question. Comment, no matter what battery technology we use, as long as we're using fossil fuel-driven power plants to generate power, to generate electricity, all we're really doing is moving the pollution from one source to another. We're not really getting rid of any of the pollution. That's the comment that I have. The question is, it seems to me that we keep looking at more and more rare earth-based technology, not only in battery technology, but all over the place. Right now, most of those rare earths are coming out of are coming out of Africa. If this is the case, what kind of geopolitical situation are we going to be facing as a result of this?
All right. Thanks for the comment and question, Paul.
This is a very good question. The electric car race and the picture of what the future could be has to be seen as a system. And so the caller, Paul, is correct. If we're burning coal, it's true that we're unlikely to get away from fossil fuels in the production of our electricity, but we have been for the last two or three years, and increasingly are moving away from coal, and we're moving for more burning of natural gas. Natural gas produces one-third of the CO2 emissions that coal does. So to the degree that we're moving at the same time toward natural gas, toward electric cars, in fact, the CO2 emissions do drop. In terms of rare earth metals, it's true most of the rare earth metals come from, they actually predominantly come from China. A couple years ago, back in 2010, 2011, 2012, there was a crisis about rare earth metals. China and Japan got into a confrontation in the South China Sea over this, and China cut off and raised the price of rare earth metals to a bunch of countries, including the United States, and that resulted in rare earth mines opening in a bunch of other places around the world, including the United States. Since then, that crisis has tamped down. China has realized that if it raises the temperature that way, then alternative sources for these metals, you know, they're called rare earth metals not because they're rare. It's just a name that they were given. In fact, these metals are all over the place. Anyway, China realizes it's going to create competition in Australia, Indonesia, and the United States, Canada. So it's stopped. It's stopped its anti-competitive behavior. And so I don't see rare earth metals as a problem when it comes to electric cars.
When we talk about rare earth metals, we talk about lithium and manganese and stuff like that?
No. Those are not rare earths are a grouping of like they have names that are that don't just come off your tongue. No. Manganese is one of the most plentiful metals on the planet, and lithium too. Although some of the places that it's located in, there are other critical problems. For example, Colombia and Bolivia. There's incredible pollution coming out of those places where it's mined, and that's another thing that needs to be resolved.
Right, I've noticed that discussion as well about if we're talking about driving these green cars, then the methods of production should be green as well, and often they're not terribly so. Steve Levine is the author of Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Steve Levine, former foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, now Washington correspondent for Quartz, QZ.com, writes about energy, technology, and politics, and they certainly intersect in his book, Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War, now out in paperback. It's about the quest for the next generation of batteries that could propel electric cars into the mainstream, where everybody would be buying electric cars instead of the niche market they represent at the moment. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and comments, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about some of the methods of production and the ways in which there's some suspicion about their impact on the environment, which brings us to an email from Steve in Medford, who writes, "Sorry, battery-powered cars are not a good idea. Like a lot of transportation prospects, it may look green when it is in the alternative transportation stage of development, but there are highly problematic scale-up problems in making battery-powered cars a transportation mode of principal reliance. Their voltage drops both in getting electricity into the battery and getting it back out again. The best idea for electric transportation is one that we threw away nearly a century ago. You can still see the remnants of electric streetcar rails in downtown Medford and elsewhere in the valley. Public transit powered by electric conduction through lines or contacts on the road might still be a tenable idea, but millions of small-scale units powered by batteries? Nope. Whatever the market demand might be for them, the math just doesn't pencil out to anything but a very brown concept," says Steve in Medford. Brown concept? Is that fair, Steve? Steve Levine?
Yes, I'm listening. It's a very interesting comment. I don't think that it's a fair comment. It's browner. It's relative. Right? It's browner than if we all walked on the street. If mm-hmm. But is it brown? No. I think that, again, we make good the enemy or I should say we make, you know, the search for the perfect the enemy of getting the good. And I do think that if you are burning natural gas to produce the electricity, if people are driving electric cars, then it's just undeniable that this is greener than the current state. Steve in Medford also raised the point of the challenges of batteries. It is true that there are terrific challenges and the physics and the electrochemistry and the physics of this. It's not like creating a semiconductor. This is the challenge that these battery researchers have every day. How do I reconfigure the transition metals and the silicon and the lithium in this battery so that when I apply the voltage to it, everything stays relatively stable, and I do everything at a relatively reasonable cost that can take a car 200 miles, 250 miles, and pivotally not catch on fire. This is what they're seeking to do, and although you know they know that the bar is very, very high, they do think that they'll get there.
Yeah, the catching on fire part is well lined out in the book, that this was a major concern with the batteries for a long time and not a completely past thing either.
Well, that's right. You know, we do read not infrequently about batteries catching fire in phones and laptops and in cars. One thing that I always keep in mind is that if you drive a gasoline-driven car into a telephone pole, it's going to explode. And so if we see a battery-driven car catch fire, we need to keep in mind the context.
All right, that does happen in other forms as well. Let's go to Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Levine.
Hello. I don't like the emphasis on making batteries for cars, and here's why. The size being a constraint, look at your handheld devices. They're a 16th of an inch thinner is big news. It's a target. I live off the grid, and I wouldn't mind seeing a battery that was three times as big as the batteries that we have now, and that was more efficient. With better batteries, we could have a distributed power system, so you wouldn't necessarily have to be able to drive your 300 miles with your battery car, because if you had quick recharge and charging stations all over the place fueled by distributed solar systems with massive battery capabilities, there would be charging stations all over the place. You could pull in for 15 minutes, walk around a little bit, charge your car, and be back on the road. And another 100 miles down the road, there would be more charging stations. If you're trying to make the car battery instead of a more efficient, larger storage battery, I'm afraid they're going to be working at cross purposes to getting transportation spread out.
All right. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Appreciate it. So, Steve, give us some idea of the struggles between not only amount of storage, therefore length of charge, but size of battery and how much that's been a trade-off.
It's not been much of a trade-off. Weight is important. The main thing is the main things have been the cost, and so the battery researchers have been struggling with that. But I wanted to zero in on a point that the caller made, and that's we've been talking exclusively about batteries for electric cars, but batteries for power electricity storage, this is the other huge area, and the points that he raises are absolutely on point. They're not at cross purposes. They're going on the research on stationary batteries and car batteries are going on in parallel, and they could have equivalent impacts, huge impacts on the world. The reason that solar panels and wind power have not made a larger splash is that you're unable to store what you create when the sun is shining, when the wind is blowing. Bringing down the cost of stationary storage and being able to install it in utilities, at people's homes, in businesses, at a reasonable cost, and creating the infrastructure that the caller described. You can charge up anywhere, charge up quickly. These are game-changing advances, and a lot of people, and when I say this, I don't mean the environmental community, but I mean Wall Street, people with skin in the game, financial skin in the game, believe that what he described is something coming in the next 5 to 7 years.
Well, yeah, it would certainly make a lot more happen for solar and wind at that point if you could figure out ways to store the juice that they create, and so it's not just there or not. Couple more comments to take in here. Patricia in Eureka writes, I've been driving my Chevy Spark EV for almost 2 years. I love my car. I do not need to travel outside of Humboldt County. My previous ride was a bicycle. We put extra new PV on our roof and are now net producers of electricity. That from Patricia. And then here's a call from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Levine, the author of Powerhouse.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and thank you, Stephen. That last comment is right on the Spark, and she doesn't need to have anything else. I think electric cars have been around for a long time, and they have worked right along. They work now. It's only going to improve. All these little criticisms about it are problems to be solved. I'm interested in this, and so I have been paying attention. There's a special website called Clean Technica, which people could check out. They follow the progress in this realm. And I report when I'm on the radio at KSKQ. Also, I go to a local club. There's only two clubs in Oregon that are dealing with electric vehicles, and one here is in Ashland, SOHEVA, S-O-H-E-V-A. And they meet the third Tuesday of the month at the Ashland Library, 7 in the evening. And about half of them are people that are buying new cars, the new electrics, and half of them are the retrofitters who are changing their trucks and cars to electric.
Like Pete Jorgensen's Metro?
Yeah, Pete Jorgensen was one of the founders originally, and there's a whole bunch of very smart people, a very exciting club to pay attention to, and we're promoting it. I'm interested because I think electric cars are one of the solutions to global warming. Your author there, Steve, seems to favor natural gas. I think natural gas is not the panacea that it's portrayed to be because of fugitive emissions are driving global warming worse than the savings you get from the carbon dioxide reduction. But in any case, there's a lot going on. The whole thing around house batteries, you've just barely touched on that. Elon Musk and others are involved in this. Toyota and Honda are dealing with some sort of a fuel cell engine, which will be in the car and can be used to run the house. So the extra storage from solar and wind that goes into these batteries units, or from the grid for that matter, and from these fuel cells and things, can be in localized batteries that can run the house. Then the car can run with a battery entirely as a pure electric, or it can be a hybrid and either have a major engine or a little dinky engine that'll get you home if you need to. And this whole notion of having to have cars that drive 300 miles in electric only is nice. I mean, people can go for that goal if they want. But I think far more exciting are small vehicles and local around-town vehicles that get me up to town to go to the movies or to buy milk or whatever without having to haul 2 tons of iron around, from skateboards to scooters to all kinds of things. BYD is a large company in China that's manufacturing a car called the Lichi, which has lead acid batteries in it. It's restricted to 50 miles an hour, but you can go around town and take care of all your business and hardly ever use a gasoline engine with an $8,000 car.
And I think BYD is also the maker of the buses that Lane Transit District is about to buy, the electric buses.
And, yeah, the BYD is also one of the main manufacturers of electric buses. They're all over the world now.
Okay.
There are enormous batteries in ferries that are running cars back and forth. There's all kinds of wonderful things going on.
All right.
And
so let's
growth will take care of this. And one final thing, there's a battery just being developed that's made out of paper, algae, and salt. It's lightweight. It runs like a capacitor. It recharges thousands of times and hold this charge. There's a lot of exciting, interesting things coming on down. So thanks, Steve. And
Thanks for that, Brad. Appreciate it. So Steve, he practically wrote your next book for you.
I love that. It was good. Okay, but I only want to throw out one thing, that what he described is the attitude of the battery enthusiasts, the folks who are already sold. How do you shift from that into the mainstream? And what do mainstream car buyers buy? Well, look at what we've been watching over the last year. Almost one out of two vehicles sold in the United States is either a truck or an SUV, a crossover, a minivan. We own a minivan. You know, we have two kids, and so the electric cars, by and large, that we're seeing so far, are sedans. Car makers have demonstrated that they're serious about the electric car age, and the reason is that by the year 2025, they have to double the efficiency of their fleets by law. Right now the average mileage 24.5 miles per gallon. They have to raise that to 54. What I think is going to happen is we're going to see a lot more electric SUVs and electric trucks. The car makers, because they want to sell these cars, they have to, in order to comply with the law, they're going to start to make the vehicles that Americans actually buy.
So an interesting combination of the consumer pressures and the pressures to perform from government regulators at the same time.
Yes, exactly.
So just a couple seconds left here. Is it going to be just a continued incremental process? Do you see from what you saw at Argonne and elsewhere that there's going to be a breakthrough someday?
Well, so the battery researchers themselves, they see what's in front of them. They are sitting at the bench knowing that there's nothing in eyesight. They describe to me nothing in their line of sight that's the answer. So they keep trying, but meanwhile, car makers and device makers are going forward. They see the answer on the factory floor, economies of scale.
All right. The book is really fascinating. Powerhouse, America, China, and the Great Battery War. Steve Levine wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right. Take care.